Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
What happened when the biggest earthquake ever to strike North America hit Alaska? John Mualim will be here to talk about his new book, This Is Chance. Looking for a book to soothe and inspire the whole family? Elizabeth Egan will join us to talk about her April pick for group text. Alexander Alter will join us with an update from the publishing world. Plus, our critics will be here for the latest in literary criticism. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's April 24th. I'm Pamela Paul. John Mualim joins us now. He's a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine, and his new book is called This Is Chance, The Shaking of an All-American City, A Voice That Held It Together. John, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this book, This Is Chance, is a book about a seismic event like our current pandemic, except that it was an actual seismic event. Tell us about the earthquake that hit Alaska on March 27th, 1964.
It was Good Friday evening, and this was the largest quake that's ever been recorded in North America. It's still the second largest one in the world. I think even more disturbingly and almost with more surreality to the experience, it lasted for 4.5 minutes. So it was an incredibly destructive quake, but it was also, there was this kind of psychic disorientation that came along with it, especially in the city of Anchorage, which was really Alaska's biggest city by far at that time, of just seeing this community that people were still very much in the process of building and inventing, just kind of being turned, you know, literally upside down in some spots.
Was the epicenter in Anchorage proper?
No, the epicenter was, it was close to Anchorage. It was just east of Anchorage under the sea. And so there were a lot of communities that were affected around Alaska. I mean, I chose to focus the book on Anchorage because, you know, like I said, it was really a place that was just beginning to get on its feet that sort of represented the promise of what Alaska could be and felt great pride in itself, but also, you know, real insecurity at that. The quake came at a very precarious moment for the community when, you know, it was really just starting to feel like it had something to offer the rest of America. And to be struck like this in such a, you know, seemingly random and very cruel way, I think really affected the self-image of the community.
I mean, Alaska is still kind of a mystery to many of us lower continental Americans. What was it like at the time?
The Greater Anchorage area was, you know, it was a city of 100,000 people in 1964, which is, you know, almost half of the state's population. And it's really the only community that an outsider probably would have deigned to even, you know, call a city. And it was, you know, it had a 14-story hotel, but that was by far the biggest building. It had kind of a new upscale neighborhood of kind of modernist homes. It had a JCPenney building, which was a really, really big deal that some big national American retailer would come build in Alaska. And so, again, it was just really kind of finding its way, you know, straining to make itself a real place when this earthquake happened. And it was feeling very insecure about its future because it didn't quite know that after this boom of statehood that it had found any way to sustain itself. It was still this feeling that this place that they were building, this arm of society they decided to build way up in the corner of the world, might be an experiment that just might not work out.
And then the ground literally shakes underneath them, getting at those very fragile new foundations. I mean, you chose in your book to focus really on the impact that the quake had on the people of Alaska. Why did you decide to approach the story in that way?
The way that I came into the story was through the story of this radio broadcaster, Jeannie Chance, who was a sort of a part-time radio reporter and working mother in Anchorage, and who by a, you know, a quirk of luck, but also her own persistence, you know, wound up being this voice on the air in the 3 days after the quake that was really able to helped the city cohere in a very disorienting and dislocating moment by passing information over the air, passing personal messages from people looking for their family members. And once you find a character like that, who's really this node for people coming together after an event like this, you start to see how all of these individual stories of the earthquake, all of these people who were tossed around separately, were really kind of joined in a shared experience.
You use the Thornton Wilder play, Our Town, as a kind of framework. Can you explain how you did that, why you made that decision?
A big thread of the story is this community theater group in Anchorage who was doing Our Town and was interrupted by the quake that weekend. I think I'd probably read the play in high school and I'm not proud to admit it, but just, you know, didn't really take it seriously. I just sort of had this impression of it as this hokey, simplistic piece of Americana. And when I started reading the play again, I realized that in some ways its themes are the themes of the story of the earthquake too. This idea that, you know, we don't recognize the preciousness or the fragility of our daily lives until we're thrown outside of it, until we get some other perspective on it. And the other weird thing that happened was that there's this character in the play, the stage manager, who is standing on stage with the characters and telling you basically how they all die in the future. And I realized that because I was spending so much time trying to recount the story of these 3 days, but I was doing it from more than half a century later, you know, I had that same kind of omniscience about these characters, and it was very painful to watch people in the course of these 3 days, you know, struggling with these issues of life and death, knowing that, you know, in one case, a month later, you know, this fellow would die in a plane crash, or this guy was going to have a stroke, and, you know, he was expecting to retire, but he'd be dead 6 weeks later. More and more, the book became kind of mimicking the structure and the way that Our Town is narrated, which I think took it to some kind of unconventional places, but it really did seem like the way that this story should be told.
And you, the author, then become the stage manager.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, it's not, you know, we don't walk around in daily life knowing the future, right? But in a weird way, this project put me in that position, and the stage manager was really the only other person that I'd seen have that same experience. So yeah, you know, for the most part, the book is this sort of intimate retelling about people in the real time of those 3 days after the quake. But I do come in the middle of the book as a character who's just in a basement with all of Jeannie Chance's, you know, 40 some odd boxes of her life, just digging through, trying to piece together that map of her life.
Let's talk about Jeannie Chance for a moment. One of the people in your book describes Chance as the whole women's movement in a nutshell. How so?
Well, you know, in 1964, she was really trapped in this predicament of being a woman in broadcasting, having real talent and real guts as a reporter, and just being mismatched with her environment. I mean, this was, you know, 1964 is when the feminine mystique came out. It was a time when, you know, people in Anchorage were not talking about feminism, right? Jeannie was also in a very abusive marriage at that time. And what you see is after the quake, I think because the quake was a moment where she really was called to take on a level of responsibility society hadn't really trusted her with before. And she rose to that occasion. She seemed to really have a new understanding of what she was capable of and made some real changes in her life, including leaving her husband. She ended up running for and winning a seat in the state legislature, where she became this kind of icon of the women's movement, as she was described to me by some younger women who really looked up to her, passing a lot of progressive legislation and kind of not taking any gruff from the older conservative men that she was surrounded with.
What kind of role did she serve for the people of Alaska at the radio station KENI?
Before the quake, she was just this reporter around town, and her voice was part of the fabric of the city. And so when she came on the air after the quake, it was really comforting for people to hear a familiar voice, just even explaining what had happened. You know, we just had an earthquake, and here's the buildings that crumbled, and here's the streets that you shouldn't be driving on. As a woman who was listening that night put it to me, you know, it's a situation where you just literally don't know what happened. Some people thought it was a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And so when you're that confused, and when you're feeling that isolated from the rest of your community, and you don't know what other damage is out there, anything that you are told is reassuring. And this woman said, you know, information itself is a form of comfort in those situations.
What are the parallels that you see between that moment in Alaska, 1964, and our current moment today?
If anything, you know, what the book is about is that there is a kind of volatility to our lives that we block out. on a day-to-day basis. And we don't imagine ourselves as living in this world that is so fragilely constructed, and that can change instantaneously in ways that we can't imagine. And when I was writing the book, that seemed like an idea that would have some resonance, be it with climate change disasters or just the pace at which our culture seems to be changing. And now I think it's undeniable, right? It's like, it's such an obvious truth that I probably didn't have to spend as much time, explaining it in the introduction.
People know it now.
Yeah. And I also think that what you're seeing now is also what you saw in the book, is that some of the book deals with these sociologists who came to Alaska right after the quake, like the day after, to study how the community was responding, with the expectation that things would be falling apart and people would be, descending into chaos and violence. And they found pretty quickly that people were very resourceful and level-headed and were, driven to work together to solve their problems and keep each other safe. And I think for the most part, we're seeing that, right now as well.
Are there particular stories in the book of people in the aftermath? I mean, there were 52 aftershocks, so it wasn't like this kind of came and ended in 4 minutes. It was an ongoing experience, perhaps not as extended as today, but of disruption and total dislocation. Are there stories that emerged from your research that you think of today as we are suffering from similar feelings of disruption and isolation, the foundation sort of literally disappearing beneath our feet?
I think it comes back to Jeannie. I think it comes back to the idea that even though, much like today, where we're all sort of sealed in our own homes and trying to isolate, the earthquake presented a kind of forced isolation for people that as one guy put it, he had just been tossed around during the earthquake and found himself at the bottom of a big hole, and said that when he crawled out of the hole, he looked around and didn't recognize his neighborhood, and he said, you think maybe you're the last man. And I think that there was something that Jeannie and the other broadcasters too that were working after the quake, that they were able to do with their voices, just to suggest that if you're hearing me, you know that I'm here, and you know that other people are listening to me too, because I'm on the radio, and that you could feel these kinds of connections, even though you were sealed off from everyone else, and even though Anchorage was sealed off from the rest of the world, that there was still a way to create that feeling of collaboration, and that we can communicate, and we can pass information back and forth, and we can leverage all of our energies to address this problem together. And I think that we're sort of lacking that feeling in some ways right now, partly because we don't have the leadership that's driving those messages. But I also think that we're finding it organically. I think people are really, we're all hungry to feel like we're doing this together, even though, literally most of us are doing it on our own.
Well, here you are, currently in a house in the woods on an island off the coast of Seattle, not as you probably would have been on a book tour connecting directly with your readers, but I hope at least reaching out to potential readers, to your readers, to other listeners, getting the word out there about other people's stories. So thank you so much again, John, for being here.
I'm really thrilled that you had me on. Thank you so much.
John Mooallem's new book is called This Is Chance, The Shaking of an All-American City, A Voice That Held It Together.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. Elizabeth Egan joins us now. She is an editor at The Book Review and writes our monthly group text column. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Pamela.
You did something unusual for the month of April. Talk about your process for picking a book this month.
This month was a little bit different. I usually pick a book that is appropriate to discuss with your book group, which I assume is a collection of fellow adults. But this month, when I sat down to write about a book for April, I realized we are really not in ordinary time right now. We are in what I'm thinking of as the new now, which is hopefully not the new forever, but most of us are home with our families who are, in my case, kind of an impromptu book group every single day. And so I picked a book that is appropriate to read aloud and to discuss with your family, if you have a family that is inclined towards discussion about books, which I will admit mine sometimes isn't. But the book is called The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse. And it's by a British writer named Charles Maxey. And it is a picture book that is intended for human beings of all ages, ages 8 to 88, I believe, is how the author puts it in his introduction.
You know, it's funny because those books for all ages somehow sort of seem to have gone a little bit out of fashion. Like, they used to have them a lot in the 80s. Well, there was The Way Things Work, of course, the David Macaulay book. There was Griffin and Sabine, as you point out in your column. Those kind of books that could sit around in the living room and anyone could pick up and get something out of it.
And they've kind of fallen by the wayside. I'm not really sure why. And I'll admit that I am often skeptical of books that are supposedly crossover books from small children to full-sized adults. But after we stopped working in the office and after we were working from home, I was having a really hard time concentrating on the books that I usually read. And I had snatched up this book as I was leaving the office. It was at the bottom of one of my many tote bags full of books. And one day when I was feeling particularly down, I picked it up and it was like a soothing balm. And I do not say that lightly. It just brought me such a tremendous sense of peace. The message of the book is very simple. It's about being brave. It's about asking for help when you need it. Not a lot happens. It has very peaceful line drawings. I compared it to The Giving Tree, but the message of it is very different from The Giving Tree, where The Giving Tree is all about somebody taking. This is a book about people sticking together.
I feel like, Liz, we could have a whole side conversation about The Giving Tree. Are you, just quickly, pro or con?
Con, strongly.
And I'm strongly pro. All right, we'll have to revisit
what?
That. I am strongly pro. I think it's the tree is obviously, this is the Shel Silverstein picture book. The tree is obviously about selfishness, but I think that for children, it's a reality and it's a huge lesson to learn that there are those in this world who are fundamentally selfish. And so I do think of it as a morality tale. It's just told through the lens of an anti-hero. But I think that kids get that.
Actually, I have to admit, I remember, of course, I read it as a little kid, but I remember as a 16-year-old rereading it and understanding a little bit more about my parents in that moment, which is a good thing when you're 16. To understand.
Shel Silverstein had his very melancholic side, and that probably was my favorite side to him. You know, the saddest thing I ever did see was a woodpecker pecking at a plastic tree. He looks at me and friend says he things ain't as sweet as they used to be. That's the kind of Shel Silverstein I liked.
Pamela, this is why you're the editor of The Book Review. I can't believe you just pulled that out of nowhere. I'm so impressed.
Oh, do not be impressed, because others on the desk can pull out, you know, like Yeats and Whitman, and that's the extent of it for me. So going back to this book, the author not only wrote it, he illustrated it as well, correct?
Yes. He is first and foremost an artist, and he's an artist who has lived many lives. I actually spoke to him after I read the book, which is not something I normally do for group text, but I was so intrigued by what made him write this book and by what it has been like for him to have it resonate so strongly in this moment.
Because it's a bestseller, right?
It has been a bestseller, I think, now for 20 weeks. People are embracing it and doing exactly what I did, reading it out loud to their entire families and finding strength from it, which is something that doesn't always happen when you read a book, no matter how much you love it. And he told me that he came to art after a friend of his died in a car accident, and he started drawing on the streets of London, and somebody walked by and invited him to have a show in their gallery. And then from there, his art career took off. But he struck me as a man with a lot of stories to tell, and you sense the depth of his compassion and kindness when you read the book.
What are the kinds of things that you suggest people might talk about? And presumably you talked about this a little bit with your own impromptu familial reading group.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to say I have three adolescents in my house, so it's hard to get them to spark up the kind of conversation I would normally have with my book group. They listened intently as I was reading. And when I was done, I said, what do you think about this message of asking for help when you need it? Or this message of, one of the pictures is of two swans on a pond. And one of the animals says, there's a lot of frantic paddling going on underneath this supposed, you know, what looks like kind of a perfect picture. And I tried to get my kids to talk about how what we see maybe on Instagram or Snapchat is not always the real deal. There's a lot of frantic paddling going on underneath the surface. And they listened. They nodded their heads. They didn't have a lot to add to the conversation, but just the fact that they stayed with me and were rapt from the beginning of the book to the end. And so was my mother, who happened to be over.
Your children were probably the perfect metaphor, the perfect analogy in that story. They were the swans appearing to be very quiet, but underneath probably having many thoughts.
Exactly.
This book has been on the bestseller list for 20 weeks. That precedes coronavirus. But you really wanted to do this book now and think that it also speaks to this current pandemic moment. Talk a little bit about why.
It's a book about taking a pause. And we're all in this moment where everything that we care about is on hold. I feel lucky to be in a house with five healthy people. That's a high class problem. But there are still a lot of things that we cared about, that we were looking forward to, that we enjoy doing, that are now on hold. And the book is about finding peace within that moment of being on hold. It's about doing not a whole lot, but finding meaning in the absence of activity, if that makes sense. And it doesn't hit you over the head with that message, but it's there. And the book has been sitting on my desk almost since it came out. You know, we all have big stacks of books on our desks. This has been at the bottom of one of mine, and it found me at the perfect moment, which I think sometimes happens. It's part of the magic of reading.
I think about our lonely desks back at the office at the New York Times on 8th Avenue in New York City, our desks piled with books, also with snacks, which I worry about.
Yes.
And what it'll be like coming back to those desks at some point. Hopefully it's after the new now and the new later.
Yes.
It'll be a very strange thing to come back and see those books that were at one point so timely.
There are so many things I miss, but the physicality of a book, those stacks the smell of the pages. Obviously, I have a million books here in my house, but I'm just getting accustomed to reading on an e-reader, and it's a different experience. I think one of the reasons I appreciate this book is that it's a beautiful physical object to hold in your hand. And I miss that.
Well, one of the points that we've been trying to make to our readers of the book review, and let's make it again here to listeners of the podcast, is that you still can get those physical books. There are hurdles, to be sure. There are delays. It's really hard to get a physical book, obviously, from a library. But this is a beautiful book. I should say it's an oversized picture book. It's really nicely produced. And so it's one that even should you go ahead and read the electronic version of Now, I hope that you will turn to when you can get your hands on what I still like to think of as a real copy of the book.
Yes, but I do think that the electronic copy could and will give you the same sense of wonder that I had when I read it. And I would encourage readers to read it out loud, because I read it to myself, I loved it. And then when I read it out loud, it took on a different meaning.
All right. Well, let's let that ebook version tide listeners and readers over. Liz, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We will see you back in May.
Yes, I look forward to it. Thanks.
Alexander Alter joins us now with some news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexander.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new this week?
So things are still holding steady in terms of sales. Obviously, it's still a challenge for a lot of booksellers around the country that are closed, but people have been pretty adaptable, shifting to online sales and other forms of getting books out, including curbside pickup, things like that. So the latest figures from NPD BookScan, which conclude with the week ending April 18th, show a dip for this year to date, which is not a big surprise. Sales were down 3.5% in 2020 compared to the same period in 2019. They did see some growth that week, though, in adult fiction, which I thought was very encouraging. Adult fiction sales were up more than 5%, and it was particularly strong in mystery, suspense, and just general fiction. And of course, juvenile nonfiction is still up enormously. It's up more than 20% this year.
I just tried out bookshop.org, which I believe you spoke about last week on the podcast, and it was a pretty seamless experience, I have to say, and probably on trend. I was ordering some children's books. You could specify a local bookstore if you wanted to go to a particular independent bookstore, or you could just sort of place your order and they would do with it as they would. And you have a kind of option to ship more quickly. I chose the less quick option, the inexpensive option, so I can report back about how long it takes. But it was a really easy experience and everything was discounted.
I think their timing really was extraordinary. They just got up and running a few weeks before things got really serious with the coronavirus epidemic. And just when all these shelter-in-place orders were coming in and businesses were closing, Bookshop was really ramping up. And they've had so many independents join their site. And it does seem to be a really good alternative for people. And also, these are stores where they can't really ship out books from their physical location. So Bookshop is sort of acting as an intermediary. I believe they're working with Ingram and getting things directly to consumers. So it is a really good system, I think.
One of the things that I heard about in the supply chain right now is that there are sort of two huge printers in the U.S. One is in bankruptcy, and one of the other main ones had to close down due to coronavirus. And so that's caused some delays on the production side of books.
Yes, and that was already starting to be an issue. Even, you know, a year or more ago, there were real crunches in the printing arena. Because one of the reasons, which is kind of ironic, is that the print facilities had assumed that ebooks would continue to grow. And then they saw that ebooks were falling and print sales were resurging. And so the capacity had already shrunk. So there was a period, you know, during the holidays when a lot of books that were selling really well were not available. They went out of print. So that was a problem. And of course, with one of the two major printing companies in real financial distress, publishers are extremely worried about that.
I guess the big lesson of the pandemic is no one can predict the future, except perhaps Lawrence Wright.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the books coming out next week, including Wright's book.
His book, and I read it on a NetGalley, is remarkably prescient to a frightening degree. And it is about a global pandemic and the social, economic, and medical collapse that results from countries being unprepared. So if you like leaning into your anxiety, I highly recommend it. I found it really gripping. And he did a ton of research. And that's why I think it feels so eerily accurate, because he talked to, you know, epidemiologists and experts about what the potential ramifications of an unchecked pandemic would be. If you would prefer something more escapist, we can talk about other books that are coming out in May that might provide a little relief from the current sort of state of anxiety that we're all in. One that I think I'm very curious to see how people react to is a prequel to The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. I'm always interested to see what happens when blockbuster authors try to continue their franchises kind of beyond the lifespan of the story that initially took off, particularly when there is a huge movie adaptation and things like that. This was something that I think was a little bit surprising because, you know, The Hunger Games sort of wrapped up so neatly and it was kind of this complete world. So with the prequel, Suzanne Collins is going back 64 years before the events that start The Hunger Games. And it'll be interesting to see if the fan base sticks around and wants to go back to it. And I have to say, I'm excited that they kept the publishing date, since so many of the big books of the spring have been moved to the fall. I think it's nice to have this still coming out.
When is it coming out?
So it's coming out on May 19th. And the title is The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. So that could be a good option for people that enjoy dystopian, but in more of a fantasy setting and not something so realistic. And a couple other books that I'm very excited about, Little Eyes by Samantha Schweblin. She is an Argentinian author who writes these sort of fantastical stories and novels, but they're kind of real. They're more realistic than not. They're sort of uncannily between the two. And so this novel is about a world in which people have become obsessed with these little toys that are operated by people in other countries or anywhere, really. So you have this stuffed animal that is a robot, but behind its eyes, the little eyes of the title, is someone remote, some stranger who's sort of eavesdropping in on your life and surveilling you willingly. So it's,
I have to say, this is like the best premise that I've heard about in a long time.
I know. A lot of people have said it reminds them of Furbies, those really creepy robotic toys or things like that.
It also reminds me of the story in Exhalation, Ted Chiang's most recent collection, called The Life Cycle of Software Objects, where you have these people creating these kind of sentient avatars.
Exactly. And it's, what's interesting about this book is, first of all, it's her first truly global novel. You know, most of her books are either set in unspecified places, like at the side of the road somewhere or in a clinic somewhere. And it's not exactly clear what the setting is, but it's assumed to be somewhere, you know, in Latin America. But Schweblin now lives in Berlin, although she's, I think, or I understand she's actually in quarantine in Argentina right now. So she's back home for a bit. But living there, she said, has said, you know, previously, really opened up her ability to write globally. And so this novel takes place, the characters are all over the world. Some of them are the dwellers, and that's what you call the person who's operating the toy. It's called a kintsugi. Other people are the keepers, and those are the people that bought the toy. And it's such a really unsettling story, and it tackles these issues that we've come to sort of accept as normal in our lives, constant surveillance from usually technology companies. In this case, it's from strangers, and how technology has changed our ideas about intimacy and love. So it takes on these really big and amorphous ideas, but through the lens of these individuals who are either keeping the toys or operating them.
All right. What are a few of the other big titles coming out in May?
Two other titles that people are really looking forward to are Stephanie Dandler's Stray. Her first novel, Sweet Bitter, was a huge hit, and it was a semi-autobiographical tale about a waitress in New York City, and it was about the restaurant scene, and people called it a Kitchen Confidential of our time. That was in our New York Times review. And her new book is fully autobiographical. It's a memoir, and it's titled Stray, and it looks at her relationship with the people in her life who have shaped her, her mother, who struggled with alcoholism, her father, who was largely absent, and a lover who was married at the time. So that should be quite interesting. People can finally tie together the person behind the book. And another book people are really looking forward to is Curtis Sittenfeld's new novel, Rodham, which is an alternative history of Hillary Clinton's life, how it might have turned out if she had not accepted Bill Clinton's marriage proposal.
So she's done the first lady or former first lady, Laura Bush. Now she's doing an almost president or would be president, Hillary Rodham Clinton. I feel like she's got to do the president next.
Yeah, I think that's probably her next project, I would imagine.
All right, Alexandra, thanks so much for giving us some good news to think about.
It was great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Joining us now are critics Jennifer Salai and Parul Sehgal. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Tamara.
Parul, very nice to have you back for your first COVID version of the podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
How are things going in terms of doing your regular job as a critic? Is it different?
I mean, I think the lack of childcare, just general level of panic and fractured attention is really all very helpful when it comes to doing work. But, you know, it's difficult. But then every now and again, you'll have the kind of week that I had where I got to review something that I was like, gosh, how can I marshal the concentration to think and review and to persuade somebody else to care about something? And then in my situation, I got to review this new translation of Chekhov's stories. So perhaps I can just jump into that. It's translated by the premier Russian translators, Richard Pevere and Larissa Volhansky. And it's 52 stories that they say is a lively take on his range. But in reality, it's the stories that they didn't translate before in a previous volume. But I mean, the thing about Chekhov that's so interesting is that, and I write about this in the reviews, that he's really almost translation proof. So even if the translation is a little bit stilted or strange, and I didn't love this translation, the way that these stories are constructed and what they're after is so powerful and so suspenseful. And even now, reading them, I was like, I don't think I've read any fiction that still feels this modern, that grabs me, that feels so quick and sure of itself and interested in crossing certain kinds of thresholds. So, you know, I picked it up feeling like, gosh, how am I going to sink into this? And then I couldn't stop. And I think the risk with Chekhov, even if your time is scant and even if you feel fractured, is once you start reading him, you kind of cannot stop. So I finished reading the new stories. And then I was like, I hadn't read the letters. Can I find the journals? Can I find anything else to sort of stay with this person that who was trained as a physician, who wrote through a pandemic?
Was a cholera pandemic?
I think it's called the second Asiatic cholera pandemic. And just had this acerbic tone, this real sort of ability to look at all of his characters as being somehow just helpless, unattractive, unambitious loafers, and he loves them, or at least he forgives them, and he's interested in where their frailties take them. And the stories always end with this last line that sort of pulls a rug out from under you, and you suddenly realize you never know what the story is in a Chekhov story until you come to the end, and then you have to reread it, and you have to keep rereading it because they're magic tricks. How is it going for me? You know, I didn't understand how I was supposed to give all of myself and all of my attention to a book. And then I had such good luck.
Some people just want to read thrillers. Some people just want to read the news. Some people have felt kind of curiously drawn to the comfort of classics. And one of the things I thought interesting about the book that you point out in your review is that this is actually the second volume that this pair of translators has worked on for Chekhov short fiction. So explain a little bit about what was in the first volume and what's in the second volume, if someone has that urge to, say, turn to Chekhov in this moment for their own reading.
The first volume contains his masterpieces, the stories that you think of as a Chekhov short story, Gooseberries, In the Ravine, The Lady with the Small Dog, all of the sort of classics. This collection contains some of the stories and some of the stories that I really love, like, for example, about love and joy and a handful of others, but it tends to range a little bit more on the early part of his career. We see a lot more of his early character sketches coming into his voice. You know, and he was somebody like Dickens who supported himself through his writing. He actually supported his medical career writing fiction, which seems crazy these days, but that's how he could subsidize, you know, studying medicine and practicing. And he practiced medicine for free for a great deal of his life. Again, as I say, like, even when he's just starting out, you can already see something always very shocking and surprising in the way that he understands character. He didn't seem to care about language as deeply as he cared about psychology, as he cared about narrative structure. So that's what I mean, that even if you pick up a translation that isn't perfect or lacking, you're never bored. You're never slogging through it. You're always a little bit perplexed at how fresh it feels and how interested you are.
What was the organizing principle for them in terms of these two volumes? Do they say, well, in this first volume, we're doing these stories or we're dividing it by time? How did they make that decision?
Hey, who knows? I mean, that's one of my grouses with this book, is that the introduction is very, very vague. And they just sort of say that here's a full deck of Chekhov. Here's something that shows you the variety of tones that he could employ, the variety of styles. They don't come out and say that, you know, these are the stories we didn't get around to translating in the first volume, or these are the stories that maybe the B-sides or something like that.
Right. Here's everything else.
You know? So it's hard to say what the principle of selection was other than variety for them. There's a huge, huge number of stories to choose from. He wrote almost, I think, 800 stories. When he died, they published his stories in 10 volumes. So there is so much to read. I mean, my feeling is always, if you're new to Chekhov, to start with some of the, you know, established stories. So maybe start with the first volume. And then if you can, find your way to the letters, because one of the things I talk about in the review is that Chekhov's goodness has been very, very annoying for his biographers and people who write about him, because he just seems to be this beacon of strength and stability and humility and generosity and a very difficult life. And I don't know, he was the custodian of his own soul in a way that can feel very, very complicated and interesting. But when you read the letters, you get to see these other sides of him, and you get to see how hard he worked to preserve that kind of equanimity, a more fully fleshed idea of the good doctor as we now know him.
You also had some quibbles with the translation itself. Can you talk a little bit about that? And who is your preferred translator of Chekhov?
The translation, and I moved between reading the stories as translated by Pevere and Volonsky to looking at Constance Garnett's stories. And then my favorite translator is Avram Yarmolinsky. I think Boris Fishman also likes him. A lot of you know, he is pretty beloved. And his translation, which you can usually get in a collected volume, is very clean. It's very musical. It sounds idiomatic. It sounds like the way that Chekhov wanted to write, you know, which was for the ear. And the volume that I reviewed, it works. It's very clear, but it's very awkward in places. Like they don't go for the clear phrase that you might be able to identify. There's a real estrangement you feel, which is especially awkward in Chekhov, because if there's one thing that Chekhov was very good at doing, I think, you sort of become complicit in the consciousnesses of these characters. You think very close to them. What they're thinking is sort of done in this very free and direct third. So you're kind of always looking through their eyes, looking through their lens. And it feels very almost painful, if you love Chekhov, to find these very familiar, beloved characters feeling a little bit separate from you. And you're not in league with them. You're not sort of scheming along with them. So yeah, these sort of like odd turns of phrases, which again, in the grand scheme of things, it may not seem hugely important, but it does lock you out of these consciousnesses, and it locks you out of that certain feeling that we go to Chekhov for. At least I do.
I find that one of the hardest things to translate is humor. Speaking not as a translator, but as a reader,
right,
that there are versions of The Master and Margarita, for example, where on the first page, I find it hysterically funny. And then ones where I can't believe how they've deadened the humor out of it.
Yeah. Plutarch has a nice quote about translation where he says that the translated book, it should be like the offspring, that it has the same sinew as the predecessor, as the original, but should have its own soul, you know? And I think about that a lot, and I don't know if I agree. I actually feel like quite the opposite. Like, I don't mind if the phrases are a little bit different, if you're not faithful sentence by sentence, but I want the soul to feel the same. I want the humor to feel the same. I want the slyness and irony to feel the same. And that's what I think is lost a little bit. Like, you lose that feeling of the author looking at you. Chekhov was always reporting on these lives, you know, almost very journalistically, almost very clinically. But he was also always winking with us, and he could see, and he could always telegraph to us how pompous some of his characters were, how self-pitying. And this one just feels a little bit too po-faced. It feels a little bit too literal, I think. And I miss, as you say, the humor. I miss some of the slyness.
Jen, you now review almost exclusively or exclusively nonfiction, but before that you did review a lot of fiction in translation. And I wonder if translation is as important in nonfiction, do you think, as it is in fiction?
I think it depends on the book, obviously. There are nonfiction authors who take their sentences, their style, you know, really seriously. And in that sense, yeah, I think, you know, what Parle said about wanting something that really conveys for an author who was so conscious of what he or she was doing, to have that style conveyed in a way that speaks directly to you, I think that's something that one always wants, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. At the same time, there are plenty of nonfiction books that are more about conveying information. But all of that said, the best ones really know how to do it in such a way where the style is really inseparable from the content. And so I do think it's important.
The book you reviewed this week is about style as much as it is. About content.
Yes. Yeah, so a book I reviewed, actually this was recently, was a book called Notes from an Apocalypse, A Personal Journey to the End of the World and Back by a critic named Mark O'Connell. And this is a case where the subtitle really gives you a sense of what it was that he wanted to do with this book, which is to convey his own, I think he uses the word obsession with the end times. He says several years ago in 2016, he started reflecting on everything that was going on in the world, from climate change to surging nationalism, and he began to feel this overwhelming sense of foreboding and dread. And, it, you know, I mean, it's interesting because I think that, you know, he completed this book. I mean, I got the galley, I think, before we were living in a world of COVID-19.
Right, so, the world was already ending.
Right, exactly. And as he does say, you know, and he's right, that, you know, an obsession with the end times isn't anything new. I mean, that's something that generations have always grappled with, especially during times of upheaval and change. And so he's really looking at a way of approaching something that people have always thought about. And he's inflecting it with his own personal sensibility. And so he travels the world. He goes to various places to see either, I mean, the one exception I would say is the Chernobyl exclusion zone, which is an actual area where there was a disaster. There was an apocalypse, you could say. He also goes to other places like New Zealand, to the Scottish Highlands, where he contemplates how people are going to grapple with a planet that's really transformed. And so it is very personal. When he was younger, he says he really was interested in the gloomy philosophy of Schopenhauer. That was something that he found really appealing and interesting. And now that he's a parent, now that his life is different, even if he does think that the end of the world is near, I mean, that's something that he does talk about, because if anybody's paying attention to the news, for example, about climate change, leaving aside COVID, that's something that the planet is going to have to grapple with regardless of what's going on right now. He does say that as the parent of young children, you know, it's his responsibility to work as if these things can be changed, that our doom is not necessarily inevitable.
He wrote this, as you said, before the current COVID-19 crisis. What was it like to read during that crisis?
You know, it's really interesting because on the one hand, it's a book that's timely. I mean, I don't think he intended it to be that way, except, you know, at the same time, it was written in a tone and a spirit where the current crisis that we're dealing with, even if it was something that you read any book about what the future might hold. I mean, a pandemic is always one of the possibilities, but I don't think it was necessarily going to play out in the way that people thought it would, or that a lot of people thought it would. So
this is not the end of the world that we thought we were going to have.
I don't know. Maybe some people did think that this is that this is what it would have looked like, but I feel like that there's certain details, I think, in the texture of people's lives. I think there's also, at least for people like us who live in New York, I think that there wasn't necessarily this sense of for instance, the hospitals wouldn't have the protective gear that doctors needed. I mean, I think that there are certain things that are just surprising. So I think it's interesting to read a book like this, because even if it was written with an awareness that all of this is possible, I think that when you're actually living through something, it changes you. And so it sort of changes your relationship to how you see the world. It changes what you're looking for, I think, when you're reading somebody else who's talking about this stuff. So that was something that I grappled with, because he's a really, you know, he's a really stellar writer. I mean, he's very stylish, very appealing, very witty. And I like that a lot. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of stuff, I think, which is understandable about his kids, his family. There was just something about it, because it was written in a spirit where it was both extremely high stakes, but also quite low stakes, that it just, it didn't quite jibe for me totally.
Meaning like high stakes for the planet sort of as a whole.
Yes. I mean, the idea of just even flying somewhere right now just seems so remote, and he can't be faulted for that. But it is just sort of interesting to think that, you know, the idea that this is how you would contemplate what's going on, when in fact, no, you're going to be trapped inside your house and you're going to contemplate how this is going on in real life. That's just sort of a interesting coincidence.
The book is, in a certain aspect, a travelogue, a travel book.
Yes.
And you kind of wonder, well, we're going to have like a whole period in which there are no travelogues.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, one of the places he goes to is New Zealand, as I mentioned, which is a place where, you know, a lot of techno-libertarian Silicon Valley billionaires have bought property.
Yeah, the Peter Thiels of the world.
Exactly. And I mean, presumably, if things really go awry, if they're not there already, they can somehow finagle a private jet to take them there. I mean, maybe that's how it's going to play out. I don't know. But it was just sort of interesting to think about.
Perhaps the last travelogue we'll be discussing for a few years. Jan Prahl, will you run down the titles again of what you reviewed?
I reviewed Notes from an Apocalypse, A Personal Journey to the End of the World and Back by Mark O'Connell.
And I reviewed 52 Stories by Anton Chekhov, translated by Richard Pevere and Larissa Volhonsky.
All right, Prahl, Jan, a pleasure having you in my closet. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.